Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 112 of Speaking of Mysteries. Today, March 28th, 2017, is Pub Day of Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted, the brainchild of Laura Caldwell, the founder and director of Life After Innocence at Loyola University Chicago, as well as a crime fiction author, and Les Klinger, the Edgar Award-winning best-selling editor of A Shelf Full of Books, as well as the co-founder of this podcast. The stories follow the arc of an exoneree's experience, starting with the knock on the door and continuing to the rebuild of their lives outside of prison. Anatomy of Innocence brings together 15 writers: Sarah Paretsky, Lee Child, Philip Margolin, Laurie King, Michael Harvey, Gail Linz, and John Sheldon, Jan Burke, Sarah Weinman, Gary Phillips, Jamie Frevoletti, John Mankiewicz, S.J. Roseanne, and Brad Parks, to write the as-told-to stories of individuals who have been wrongly convicted. But I'll let the editors of Anatomy of Innocence tell you more. Here are Laura Caldwell and Les Klinger. I was telling Les before you got on the line, as we worked through some of these issues, that it was not an easy book to read, but I think everybody, regardless of where you stand on anything, should read this book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love you saying that. Now, it's interesting. Can we talk about that? I just think that's interesting because Les and I, our hope was sort of that by quickly putting at the end of the story, okay, by the way, they got out, and, you know, here's what they've done, and kind of like here's how they get pulled into it. We hope that by making like a little bit of sense about it, that maybe it would soften the blow. But I know it is really, it's just a tough subject, you know.
I'm going to let you guys talk about this because you're much more knowledgeable.
Well, let's start. I get to be both interviewer and interviewee. Maura, let's start with how you got into this. I mean, you started out, you were a civil litigator. You began to write. You were writing thrillers, mystery fiction. And then you had a turn. And here you are today. And how did you get from being just a regular writer to being the activist that you are now?
You know, it's always interesting when I look at that, Les, because the real reason I got pulled into sort of the innocence world is because of Jovan Mosley, a client and now a friend who I represented with another friend of mine, Kathy, when he was charged with murder. And he was innocent, and it was a very intense experience, but it's one I only would have been able to have had I been a writer. In other words, sure, the fact that I was a lawyer put me in the courtroom once I found out that my friend Kathy was doing this case for free and that this kid was innocent. But I would, you know, you have to be certified to try murder trials in Cook County. I am not, but she was. But even more than that, everybody specializes in big urban areas. And so when you specialize, I used to do medical malpractice defense. That like really did not prep me. So the only reason I got to do it was that because I had stopped my law practice and I was a writer and actually had the time, and it just seemed like once I heard about the case, how could I not use my legal skills, whatever they were, and pretty rusty, but how could I not use them once I heard about the case?
So you wrote a book about this case, we should point out. It's a lovely book called Long Way Home. And for those who want to know more about Jovan Mosley in that case, that book is still available.
Long Way Home, A Young Man Lost in the System and the Two Women Who Found Him. And Les, can I just interject? Did you see on my Facebook page that I was in Paris last week and I ran into my client, Jovan Mosley, in front of the Eiffel Tower?
Well, it's a tribute to how well you did for him and how well he's done for himself that he's now in Paris.
Right. So when I represented him, though, when he was released, his family had his, you know, parents were not together and they were living separately and in situations where they couldn't take him in. And one brother was away, another brother had passed away. There was just no one to take on this kid who didn't know what a cell phone was and certainly didn't know what Google was, and it seemed to him like a whole lifetime had passed while he'd been in there. When I looked to devote some of the funds from the book to people who help out innocent people once they get out, it was tough to find organizations. There's these amazing innocence organizations who are working their butts off, not only to get people out, but they do help them when they get out. I was at the Innocence Conference this weekend and hearing from one lawyer after another who talked about having their client sleep, in their kid's bed and in the basement and giving money. But that's not their mission and that's not their work. So I started an organization at Loyola University Chicago Law School called Life After Innocence to at least just in Illinois to address the needs of exonerees, people who've been exonerated once they got out.
You had one case that you document in the book. I'm feverishly looking for it because I can't remember the guy's name, where they basically opened the door, pushed him out. He had no money. He had no clothes. He had some clothes that he had picked up from people who had been arrested that didn't fit. And an old friend happened to drive by and, say, whoa, can I help you? Who drove him, I think, to his mother's house or sister's house. And that's when you were just talking about what happens after the exoneration. That, it's sort of, that's painful. You're out of prison, but you can't go anywhere.
Right. And, that's interesting you bring up, that's Antoine Day,
yeah.
One of my clients who I was able to represent to get a certificate of innocence, which is an official declaration from the state that you are, in fact, innocent, not just not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I saw him over the weekend, and I was introducing him to John Mankiewicz, who's one of our writers and executive producer of House of Cards. He was asking Antoine about that chapter. He's like, wait, I don't understand. So your case has been appealed. It's been overturned. The county drops the charges. And then what? He said, my attorney, who had kind of come out of nowhere to save Antoine, he had other things that were going on that afternoon because the state had sort of dropped the, we're going to drop your case, sort of just plunked it in there. And also, when you're in county, you have to go back and be processed, and it can take 2 hours. In fact, it's taken 2 days. There are class action suits about it. You just literally don't know. They don't tell you when they'll let the person out. And in Antoine's case, it was 5, 6, 7 hours later and dusk, and it was April, and it was raining. And Jovan, the friend of mine that I represented, he was given, somebody gave him a bus card. Maybe they just felt bad for him. Antoine got nothing. So he literally was walked out onto the street. I mean, I freak when I don't have my cell phone, but he had nothing. No ID, no money, no cell phone. And then, yes, as you said, Mary Sheck, I've heard him say that exonerees are the luckiest unlucky people. But all sorts of, sort of miracles oftentimes happen in these stories. And in this case, you're right, a friend of his happened to be driving by and looked at him like he'd seen a ghost. He said, Antoine? And he said, what are you doing? And Antoine said, yeah, man, I just broke out. And they laughed and laughed. And Antoine said, it was like the first laugh I had as a free man. And one of the first real ones I'd had in about 10 years. So the friend put him in the car. He took him to a Target or a Walmart or something, got him a bunch of clothes and drove him over to his mom's house, who didn't know he was coming either. She thought she was seeing a ghost, and it was just this amazing kind of reunion that they were able to have. So, yeah, the book, sort of goes through the stages of wrongful conviction, from the knock on the door to hearing things at trial to going to prison to try to get out. And then at the end, like Antoine's, we have a couple of stories about what's it like to get out. And so all these stories are intended to be for the reader a look into what it's like to be in the skin and see through the eyes of someone who has been wrongfully convicted. You know, I think Les and I are thankful for Making a Murderer and Serial and shows that have really put in the public consciousness this issue of wrongful convictions and the fact that they simply do happen, and that we simply must pay attention to the fact that they do happen and let's address them. But we were happy for the fact that those, you know, shows had come out because they really showed that this is an issue in the United States. It's just the human system.
I feel like we feel now like we're on a trend, but there's a long history to it. I mean, you started Life After Innocence 6.5 years ago. This book, I don't know when you first conceived it, but you and I first talked about it probably 3 years ago, in the spring, in the early spring of 2014. And you may have had the idea before that. So this book is not some quick response to a trendy subject, Nancy.
Right.
This has been a long road to get this book out the door, and it started with an idea in Laura's head back then.
When I as I was reading this book, it brought to mind actually Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, where you are taking this journey through the eyes of these men and women as told to by these fantastic writers. And I guess that's my next question is, you know, first of all, you've gone through this journey. As Laura said, I thought that was a really well done way of structuring this, from the knock on the door to being pushed out onto the sidewalk with nothing in your pockets, pockets of which don't even belong to you. They're not even your clothes. That's what it was. It was this, you could look through the eyes of these people as told to you by these really talented writers. And so you got the idea, and then you asked people like John Mankiewicz and Lee Child to please write these things. And so that, I think, is that's another tale for you guys to tell us.
It's such a tribute to those writers, and to the, as Les said, there is a tradition of writers being troubled by injustice and doing things about it. We mentioned in the introduction Earl Stanley Gardner, and as you know, we have in the book an unpublished Arthur Miller piece that is the first to come out since his death, and he, you know, writes about how he was incensed with this issue and really helped to free a gentleman named Peter Riley, who I just got an email from last week and who's doing well and remembers getting picked up by some people, and one of whom was Arthur Miller, and he didn't really conceptualize until somebody said, "You ever heard of Marilyn Monroe?" So, yeah, it turns out it's been a long tradition in the writing world, and we were almost sort of surprised how people jumped on so quick. Sometimes we had a number of people who wanted to be involved and for various scheduling reasons couldn't be, but wow, like every person who, you know, just really wanted to be involved. And the writers did extensive we kept telling them, let us do the research. You just talk to the exoneree, get to know them, and here's your snapshot chapter. But as John Mankiewicz was being interviewed this weekend for NPR, All Things Considered, he said, yeah, you know, Laura and Les gave me this dossier on Jerry Miller, but I needed to suss out every fact. And he looked at Jerry across this radio booth, and he said, I was writing for an audience of one. He said, the whole time I kept thinking that for 26 years, the only word on the street about Jerry Miller was that he was a rapist and had done horrible things. And so I wanted this to be something about him that was totally the opposite, and I wanted him to be happy with it. So they really went above and beyond. I mean, in addition to, you know, devoting their time. Some of them, like Brad Parks, went and talked to a juror. He tracked down one of the original jurors who remains troubled about the case and the fact that she wasn't able to hold out and change the verdict.
She was the foreperson of that jury, if I recall that story.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention some of the other writers. I just pulled two out of the air. But they are, Sarah Paretsky, Philip Margolin, Laurie R. King.
Right. Jan so you'll Burks, notice a pattern here, Nancy.
Sarah Weinberg.
These are friends. Well, they're all friends of ours. But it started out, I think Lee was one of the very first on board. And when we went to publishers, and by the way, we ended up at Norton, who has been my longtime publisher, and they've just been wonderful, wonderful to work with, wonderfully supportive of the book. And when we went to Norton, we had one or two writers lined up. I don't think we had them all. But of course, as we were able to say to people, well, Lee is going to do the book. Well, Sarah is going to do the book. People just jumped on. And it was a joy. We had to eventually turn away some people, but even those who couldn't contribute, like Michael Connelly, for example, who was too busy with other stuff, was eager to support the book and wrote us a lovely blurb for the book. So it was an important book for the mystery community to get behind. We felt that way in the beginning, and the community responded.
And we should also mention that Scott Turow, who is both a criminal attorney, or was, has written an introduction. And
Barry Sheck. Barry wrote we ended up calling it sort of a co-introduction.
And both of them were powerful.
Co-forward, yes.
Co-forward.
We just had great writers. Michael Harvey, Gail Linz, longtime friend, a major thriller writer, Sarah Weinman. Who has written other nonfiction books, S.J. Roseanne. I'm going to leave people out. Gary Phillips. I'm going to forget people as well.
Michael Harvey. So, I'm looking at the book. Michael Harvey, Jan Burke, Gary Phillips,
Jamie Frevoletti.
Frevoletti, yes. Thank you. It's a who's who of people who write crime fiction. And in Sarah Weinman's case, she writes some pretty awesome true crime.
Well, that was the intent. So I want to ask Laura about the next step, because I'm still in awe about it, which is that Laura and her students, her clinic at Life After Innocence, then took on the next part of the job, which was to talk to exonerees, seek permission to tell their stories, get them involved, pick out whose stories were going to be used. And then Laura did the first draft of sort of pairing the exonerees and the writers. So, Laura, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was, there was a couple of law students who were interested in what happened in the writing world. But also, it was a good time for us to look at not all of the exonerees that are featured in the book are clients of Life After Innocence, but some of them are. And I find, Life After Innocence at Loyola in Chicago, the law students are so blown away to work with someone who got caught up in the very system that they are training to be in, and in fact, they're training to take over, and someone who has gotten so caught up, and to see the harm and also the inspiration and the joy, like, firsthand is really great to them, and they always are interested in learning how and why and what first got them brought in. I don't understand. So we gave, we were able to do a number, just a lot of research, and give every writer a dossier about the whole case, why they got pulled in, what testimony was there, what efforts were made, how did they get out, what are they doing now. But, as we said, the writers just definitely piled on with their own research. I mean, they're, so incredible. I mean, Jamie Frevoletti, who you mentioned, wrote about the Antoine Day piece, and we've spoken about him, but they, formed this friendship, and Jamie got him, by the way, Jamie writes her own mysteries, and then she writes part of the Robert Ludlum series. So she was able to set up this kind of a music gig for Antoine, because he's a mad drummer and he loves to play. And so our authors, once they were given the dossier, number one, they often went above and beyond in terms of research. And then we found they went above and beyond in terms of time spent. I mean, Lee Child drove out to the home of Kirk Bloodsworth, who was the first man exonerated from death row by DNA. And Kirk showed him through his studio, and he works with metal. And, you know, I didn't tell Lee, like, you should go out to Pennsylvania. And then over the weekend when I was with John Mankiewicz and Jerry Miller, and they were talking with NPR, the host asked, you know, how long do you think you guys probably talked? And he said days. And Jerry said almost weeks.
Wow.
And we had no idea. So it's really been a lovely surprise. Maybe we're not surprised because we knew that these are some great people and very generous people, but everybody just really seemed to go above and beyond. You know, the other one that I think this goes back to a question of yours, Nancy, you know, how can a judge or how can a defense attorney or how can a prosecutor, you know, maybe see something that might indicate that the person might be innocent and not do something about it. John Sheldon, who is Gail Lynn's husband, they wrote the piece together about Audrey Edmonds, a blonde suburban mom from Wisconsin who was taking care of some other neighborhood kids, and she was accused of killing one of them. So she lost her own kids and her own family and went away. And John was a judge and a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. He's from a smaller area in, I believe it's in Maine, and he'd worn all these different hats. And so what Les and I were asking him to do was put them all back on, and then hers, put her hat on too, and keep your eyes open and don't get defensive if you can help it. And he said it was just an amazing exercise, and he learned so much. And Nancy, you know, your question about why would people in the profession like maybe see something and not do something about it? I think a lot of times they don't see it because there's tunnel vision involved, and I get it too. When I think somebody's super innocent, I jump to more positive conclusions. They jump to more negative conclusions, and if they've already decided you did it, you're pretty much SOL. I mean, it's like everyone's so confused about the Amanda Knox case. What happened there? I'll tell you what happened. It's very simple. They thought it was somebody else, but they couldn't figure it out at first, and this guy wasn't caught till he went into Germany. And without having, like, someone to point it on and all the pressure, and that's what happens a lot, too, community pressure to get closure of a case, they just decided, okay, it's Amanda. And they start throwing everything they can find that way. And people seem unable to back up. And I think the inability to admit wrong has to probably do with getting into the system for a very good reason. People who are prosecutors are, a lot of my students have become prosecutors, and they're amazing. And they get into it because something bad has happened maybe to their family, or they have, they really just want to stick up for the rights of victims and crime victims. So I think getting into it for the right reasons, they then almost can't possibly imagine that they could have contributed to that. And I think just as humans, it's kind of a sock in the stomach when you think about wrongful convictions. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. The average Joe doesn't want someone in jail who's innocent. It just kind of, I think, touches on our humanness, and I think it almost, people can't sort of live with it. I did meet an amazing attorney, Tom Breen, who was instrumental in helping to exonerate Michael Evans. And so Michael was the third chapter in the book, or fourth, where it talks about hearing the guilty verdict, because every person thinks they're going to hear not guilty. In that case, after 26 years, Tom Breen, who was the very prosecutor on the case, it was like a big feather in his cap, as Michael always says, that he won that case, because it was about the killing of a little girl. And he, though, later had the, like, immense compassion and wisdom to, when asked, say something about the case as, you know, DNA testing had come up and new things and this and that. And sure enough, DNA was able to free Michael. So you'd think that he would be praised for this, but in fact, what I've learned is that he got shunned a lot from his office, from people, from other prosecutors, and from people like cops. And, you know, it's an issue everywhere, and it's definitely not praised. So it's almost little upside, I think.
Well, this gets back to, Nancy, what I was saying to you earlier about what we hope for this book, the theme of the book. This is not an indictment. This book is not intended to point the finger at bad prosecutors, bad law enforcement officials, bad judges. It's intended to make people aware that this is a human system, that this is a system that screws up once in a while, maybe a lot more frequently than we think, and that when we find those mistakes, they need to be fessed up. They need to be dealt with. And as Laura's pointed out, sometimes the people involved are just unable to do that, and it takes outsiders to bring that to light. But our hope is to raise the awareness of the public. And certainly we see in the last year or so that the prosecutors are becoming more aware of this. We're seeing more and more conviction review units being created out of prosecutors' offices. L.A. has a prominent one now, where they're actually going back and taking a look and saying, did we make a mistake here?
And, you know, Les is right. The two, Illinois has among the highest numbers of wrongful convictions. And among the two of the troubled counties have been Cook County and Lake County. And yet both of their recent state's attorneys have made really great efforts to look at these cases when it's been brought to them. I think sometimes they haven't made decisions that people hoped, but they made a very good faith effort to really go back and look at it and talk to everybody and have it investigated by their own office. And that is all, really, frankly, people, that's enough. Like, if we could get the average prosecutor to make a pledge that, you know, we don't want them inundated, we don't want prosecutors' offices spending inordinate amounts of time necessarily, and have it be, you know, that's not how the system is intended to work, but it certainly seems to be, and I hope we'll be able to say in this in 2 years, oh my gosh, isn't that so great? How every prosecutor's office now, every DA's office has one of these wrongful conviction integrity units that includes people from the outside. It's really not enough to say, we have a wrongful conviction integrity unit. It's like a corporation saying, we have internal auditing. Okay, good, you know, but sometimes somebody's got to come in and check it out from the outside. And so that's what we're seeing. You know, we're seeing a lot of that as well. And I think Cook County might be hopefully leaning toward that kind of a system.
Well, we're having this conversation on the day before the official pub date. But I know that the book was available at Left Coast Crime a week or so ago. So I wanted to ask what was the response to those people who have seen the book, which might be indicative of how the public will respond to this book. It's also, as Les mentioned, it's one of the books picked by Newsweek. And Laura, you're telling me you are on NPR, so. I think everybody should read this book, but that's just me.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. So, we were, first of all, very surprised that the book was actually in Honolulu because it was last week. It was 2 weeks ago. So it was 2 weeks before pub date, but Norton worked hard to get the book there, as we asked them to. And the reception, the panel consisted of Lori King, a woman named Ginny Hench, who is the director of the Hawaii Innocence Project, and me. And frankly, most of the response in the audience was stunned silence. I mean, people were just so visibly moved by the stories being told from the panel and the topic of the book. that they were just blown away. We sold a bunch of books there, which we're pleased about. And of course, I didn't have a chance to talk to people afterwards about, have you read the book? Because they were busy with other things. But certainly the public response to date has been amazing. Kirkus Review, we were delighted, gave it a starred review and called it a powerful and harrowing anthology. And I mean, frankly, the message, it was a little odd. Laura, I don't know if you've signed any books yet, but I've signed a couple. And I find myself writing, Susie, prepare to have your heart broken.
Oh.
Well, it's true, though.
Gosh. Yeah, maybe we should have a warning. Take them one at a time. These can be tough. And, you know, the whole point was that you should be able to pick up any of them. You know, if for example, going along in each in order, if it's just you feel too much. I mean, it was intended, the entire book was intended to hang as its own narrative from start to finish. So we'd love it read that way. But actually, it just doesn't matter. We made each of those pieces to be standalones, and the authors worked so hard to really just make each kind of, like, it's really sometimes it's a moment. It's a moment when somebody decides, I'm going to sign that paper. You know, everybody's always, you know, interested in how someone falsely confesses. We've now got a good example with Making a Murderer, but that sort of moment, you know, they were able to just really, really just hit in on it. I think these thriller writers like Lee Child and Sarah Pretzky and Jamie Fravoletti and the other people we've talked about, I mean, they're such studies of human nature. And in particular, usually a character or two of theirs is in some way caught up in the criminal justice system or is on the outside looking in or is, you know, people bring a lot of army experience. But they are masters of understanding bigger systems and then being able to portray how some character, how someone maybe named Jack Reacher would live within that system that they have learned. And so I think they were able to do that in like a microscopic way.
And Laura gets the credit, by the way, for, as I said, at least the first pass of suggesting who worked with whom. And I think the pairings ended up just working terrifically. Laurie King was wondering how she got picked to work with Ray Fowler. But as she got into it, I mean, Laurie's a person who is very, shall I say, intellectual and meticulous about details and all that, and ended up reading the entire trial transcript to write the chapter about the trial. She didn't just want to rely on what Ray Fowler had to say about the trial. She wanted to hear it from an objective perspective as well. And so I again, just kudos to Laura for having made such great picks to pair people up. Nancy, I'm deeply disappointed you haven't gone out of your way to comment on the notes.
The notes were brilliant and well worth, I mean, the notes do a wonderful job of illustrating the points. You know, this is when this happened, this is when that happened. This is a demonstrative of X or Y. And it's a nice little bringing the story into
context.
Into context, and I was going to say into a relatable place, although that sounded stupid, but I can't think of better words.
No. The idea of the notes was that people need to understand these are not isolated stories. There's a bigger picture here. It's a horrifying picture statistically, and we needed to convey that. I mean, we didn't want to write a long, boring a treatise, but we thought that to mix together the facts, the especially the information from the National Registry of Exonerations with the stories would put them into context. Laura, do you want to mention how we happened to get the Miller essay?
Yeah, Rob Warden is a friend of mine and the former director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern. And we were having lunch, and I was telling him about this book, and he and I had talked years ago about trying to write something and what could maybe mystery writers do with it, and we couldn't quite conceptualize it, and I was telling him, yeah, I'm finally doing it. And I told him, you know, we take you along this ride of what it's like from the inside to be wrongfully convicted. And, you know, we'll show how the person first got into prison. How did they handle the horrors of prison? How did they start to look to get out? How did they get hope? And I said, and unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do the chapter that we had hoped about, how sometimes the community, sometimes it's not a lawyer or it's you, you know, you being your own lawyer. Sometimes it's someone on the outside who has to get you out. And we've been hoping to write about the West Memphis Three. I saw a couple of these guys this weekend. They were caught up in just a horrific case that said because they played like Metallica and Black Sabbath that they were devil worshippers and therefore had killed these people. A lot of people came out in their support, including Eddie Vedder and Johnny Depp and all sorts of people. And then recalled that, unfortunately, they had had to take this sort of formalistic plea just to get released. And so we just wanted to cover people's cases who had, you know, had a declaration of innocence, had been very clean. And Rob is just sort of looking at me as I'm telling him this story, and he says, "You want Art Miller?" And I say, "What do you mean?" He goes, I got a piece about Art Miller saving a kid in New York." And I'm like, "What?" So he had, in fact, had a letter from Arthur Miller, who had just apparently moved offices or homes, and who scratched out his address and put in this other one and gave the rights to the story. And we reached out to the estate, and they were thrilled for it to be included. So we're really proud, and our thanks to Rob, because it was just, it's an amazing, it's really a nod to what Les mentioned, that this has been a tradition of writers seeking justice for people, and it's sort of a nod to that and a reminder. I mean, you know, hopefully we'll get some other writers to keep it going forward.
It was an interesting experience also in that Peter Riley, the subject of the essay, is now a man in his 50s and has not been involved really in the exoneree community, in the innocence movement at all. And we wanted to get his permission to use this essay. And I, you know, found him in the phone book in Tolford, Connecticut. There he was. And he was more than eager to get involved in and now I know actually has gotten more involved. He actually taught a class about wrongful convictions and the whole system, and use the book for that class.
So do you think there'll be more books like Anatomy of Innocence 2? Are you thinking about getting the band back together?
I've always kind of just hoped to eventually be able to talk more about After Innocence, which is my sort of specialty and what I've been studying and working with at Loyola for a while now. But, you know, I mean, the getting out of prison is a very surreal experience for anyone, whether you committed the crime or not. It's very, very surreal. But I would argue that it's even more surreal for exonerees because they spend the entire time trying to maintain enough emotional tenacity to believe in themselves when no one, often including family members, believe in you. And so to then layer on a time warp of some 20 years maybe, the longest person that we know of served 39 years before being declared innocent. And that is just a sci-fi movie. That is really... maybe that's how we'll get into Comic-Con, Les. Maybe we'll have...
There you go. There you go. Well, Nancy... The short answer, Nancy, is that we haven't given it a lot of thought, but there's tons of material. And if this book garners the attention that we're hoping, and I mean, we've been talking to television production companies. We've been talking, obviously, we're doing a good deal of radio for this. And who knows? I think there's lots of material to do a book that goes on.
So, but in order to sort of talk about After Innocence, I think you need to, you know, the hope was that people would get more familiar with the thought that, okay, it does happen, and here's a little bit about what that feels like. Just, let's just all keep that in mind, and let's praise people who say, you know what, I'd like to look at an old case. God, I mean, I want to start giving them awards. You know, like, that should be a great, like, honor to go back and do that. It shouldn't be, it's not an embarrassing thing, you know. But this is moving kind of fast these days, so it will be interesting to see what happens. And, yeah, you never know.
Nancy, it's been a delight to be on the show. I'm on all the time.
It's your show. It's your show.
I know, but it's been a delight to be on with Laura and talk about this. This has been a project of momentous importance to me. I tweeted about it this morning about how I feel like this is the most important book I've ever worked on. And it's all thanks to Laura. It's all thanks to Laura. So.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, thank you so much, Nancy.
Well, thank you, and Les, and thank you for being on the podcast. Les didn't have any choice.
But thank you
for doing this, and thank you for writing the book. Thank you for editing the book.
So Laura and I will be at Barnes & Noble in New York on Wednesday night. We will be at R.J. Julia Bookstore in Connecticut Thursday night. We will be at Loyola Law School Friday afternoon and Centuries and Sleuths Bookstore in Forest Park, Illinois, on Saturday afternoon, and we hope to see readers there.
And, of course,
all of our events are at anatomyofinnocence.com.
Anyway, thank you, Laura and Les, for doing this.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. We'll keep you posted.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye, you guys. Thanks a lot.
We'll be speaking tomorrow night.